CJSF 90.1 FM, we are here for you. And we love that you are here for us. All the effort and inspiration of hosts and programmers is in the hopes you'll find something worthy of your time. I'm Jesse, host of the Vancouver Mixtape on Sunday nights at 8 p.m. And I'm super glad you're joining us today and every day. Stay tuned. There's more great radio on its way to you.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia, this is CJSF 90.1 FM.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, underground fungal networks pulsating with nutrients, storing mountains of carbon.
Just an enormous underground nutrient system below our feet that's just pulsating with carbon and nutrients and consistently flowing. I think that's what people don't really understand, is just how dynamic and fluid the nutrients are inside these networks.
On tops, ancient cedars grow against all odds.
This is a cedrus seedling, Cedrus libani. We find it in most forests in Lebanon, but we use it mainly for reforestation. This is from a seed germinated here inside the lab. Now this seedling is ready to be put back in its natural habitat.
And looking back at a cosmic event of colossal proportions that rippled space-time.
It was an amazing event in the history of astrophysics, I would say. It was a new era in astrophysics where you're combining gravitational waves, physics with electromagnetic radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum, from radio all the way to high energies.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before launching in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. It's a vast living web beneath our feet, a tangled underground network of microscopic tubes weaving through the soil, pulsating with nutrients, tying the roots of trees and other plants into networks that extend over square kilometers. Mycorrhizal fungi, they're called. Most plants rely on them entirely. In exchange for plant sugars, mycorrhizal fungi provide phosphorus and nitrogen, but they do more than just feed plants. They cycle carbon from atmosphere to soil, helping to regulate Earth's climate. Underground fungi face a host of threats from above. Soil scientists have come together to protect fungal networks and are calling on citizens to do the same. Toby Kears is the founder of SPUN, the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. I spoke to Toby Kears at her lab in Leiden in the Netherlands.
So I co-founded SPUN, which stands for the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. And it's a nonprofit to map and protect the Earth's underground fungal networks.
And what are these underground fungal networks?
So when we talk about underground fungal networks, we're talking about mycorrhizal fungi. And mycorrhizal fungi are a class of organisms that form a symbiosis with plant roots. And they forage in the soil for phosphorus and nitrogen, and then they exchange these resources for carbon from the host plant. So basically, plants are covered with these fungal networks, and they're feeding them carbon that they fix from the atmosphere, and they feed it to arbuscular mycorrhizae in the form of sugars and fats. And so the fungi can't live without this carbon, and so they rely completely on their carbon source from these roots. And in exchange, they're providing phosphorus and nitrogen that allow the plants to grow big and healthy.
And you said arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. What's the distinction?
Yeah, so we have two major classes of mycorrhizae, and one is called arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. And they're called arbuscular because they form these beautiful tree-like structures inside a plant root cell. So the fungus actually penetrates into the cell and forms this beautiful structure that almost looks like a mini tree. And that's where the site of nutrient exchange happens, carbon for phosphorus or nitrogen. And this is the type of fungi that really, they're what we call obligate biotrophs. That means they depend completely on plants for all of their carbon. And so as a result, they're fed an enormous amount of carbon, and they actually help create a large carbon sink underground. They help carbon accumulate underground. So that's one of the major types of these mycorrhizal fungi. The other are what we call ectomycorrhizal fungi. Ectomycorrhizal fungi are interesting because they never penetrate into the plant cell, but they grow a beautiful structure on the outside of the host root. And again, plants are feeding carbon to them, and the fungus is growing out into the soil and collecting nitrogen and sometimes phosphorus and exchanging it. And these types of networks tend to be associated with conifers, so like our fir trees and our pine trees, whereas the arbuscular type tend to be associated more with deciduous trees that lose their leaves, let's say. That's a good way to think about it, or grasslands, shrubs. But those are just broad categories. Within that, there's always interesting exceptions.
Could either of them exist without the other? Do the trees require the mycorrhizal fungi, and do the mycorrhizal fungi require the trees?
That's a great question. So for the arbuscular mycorrhizae, they do. They really require this symbiosis to be a functioning organism and actually reproduce. They need to have this carbon from the plant. The ectomycorrhizae, they can survive for longer amounts of time. They can make mushrooms, but still they get fed an enormous amount of carbon from plant roots. And if we think about the other question that you asked, can plants survive without mycorrhizal fungi? That's a great question because it really takes us back to the root of the symbiosis. So plants basically evolved on land because of a symbiosis with fungal partners. So if we go way back in history, you know, some 400 million years ago, plants were largely confined to an aquatic environment. And it wasn't until they made this partnership with fungi that they started to be able to colonize a terrestrial habitat. So you can almost think of this partnership leading to this giant, you know, explosion of land plants. It was through this partnership that plants could start to get nutrients from that hardy rock, not even soil yet, but that's what the terrestrial earth was made of a long, long time ago. So this partnership allowed plants to move from an aquatic environment to land. And so actually, you know, people that study the symbiosis, they tend to think of the fungi as really the core component of plant biodiversity, that it's the fungi that are actually farming the plants. So it kind of changes your whole worldview when you realize just how important these fungi are for driving plant survival and colonization of the earth.
And their total biomass is huge. Has anybody estimated the total mass of fungal networks beneath the surface of the soil?
Yeah, so people have been trying to get at these ideas of how massive are these fungal networks. And again, it really varies on the habitat that you're looking at. But some work has shown that anywhere from 30 to 50% of the living biomass of soils can be made up of these fungal networks. So just to give you an idea of how massive that is, if you're to take, let's say, a hectare of grassland and lay out all of the fungal network in that hectare is one long line, it would be equivalent to about 12 million lengths of the Amazon River in one hectare of grassland. So again, just an enormous underground nutrient system below our feet that's just pulsating with carbon and nutrients and consistently flowing. I think that's what people don't really understand, is just how dynamic and fluid the nutrients are inside these networks. So our lab is really trying to focus on these flows, understand how these flows of nutrients are controlled by fungi underground.
And you can actually see the flow.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we've been doing in collaboration with ELMOF, which is a physics institute here in the Netherlands, is we've developed tools to actually be able to look at the flows inside these networks and start quantifying how fast they move, when they change directions. You know, how does this bidirectional movement happen inside these networks? And when I mean bidirectional, what I need you to picture is a river that's floating two directions simultaneously. So the north side of the river would be flowing one way and the south side of the river would be flowing another, but no barrier in between it. So how do these flows happen? How did they evolve? And how are they under fungal control?
I mean, how do they happen?
Yeah, that's exactly it's surprising even to me that this could be the most ubiquitous and probably the most important symbiosis on Earth, and we still really don't understand the flow dynamics. So it's quite an open field right now, trying to understand the biophysics of how these flows are controlled underground. We know that there are molecular motors that are contributing to these flows along the inside of what we call the fungal hyphae. So those are the long tubes of fungi. So molecular motors are very small motors that move nutrients around. And you can see, when you study these flows, you can see how nutrients kind of start to attach to almost to the sides of the wall and move in different directions. So we know that molecular motors play a role, moving in different directions at the same time. We also think that there's a very, very important contribution of pressure-driven flows. And that's really what we're trying to understand now, is that the cytoplasmic contents inside these networks, that liquid, is under a lot of pressure. And we think that the fungi might be able to change the direction of those flows by changing the pressure inside those tubes. You have to remember, these are microscopic rivers of nutrients, and they're flowing really fast. So inside a fungal network, it would feel like you are moving about 50 kilometers an hour, 30 to 50 kilometers an hour, but that's just the average speed. They can get up to speeds that are really, really quite high. So we talk about speeds of about 100 microns per second, right? It's hard to imagine what it's like to be inside a fungal network, but basically it feels like you're moving inside a pretty steady moving car, I would say.
And they're vast, I mean, spatially. What kind of, and some of these guys are, I mean, they're individuals. These are individual organisms.
You're asking all the hard questions, right? I mean, defining an individual in these fungal networks is incredibly difficult. Because
I mean, they're continuous.
They can be continuous, exactly. They can be continuous for kilometers. The issue is that they have a very different genetic system, let's say, which are quite easy to define genetically. They've got multiple nuclei inside their networks that can be different. So their genomes are not necessarily inside that network. These nuclear contents that are flowing and fill up the spores, which are the reproductive units, are not always exactly the same. So what is an individual if it's not the exact same genetic makeup? For example, you can take two different strains within the same species, grow them together, and sometimes they fuse. They fuse these bridges and they start sharing nuclei. They start sharing resources. Other times you can grow them and they can be a little bit, you know, genetically different. And instead of forming bridges and sharing nutrients, there's conflict. And they start growing and competing to try to get resources to feed to the roots. So I think we're at this point in science right now where we're really trying to understand, yeah, what is an individual, and when do you see fusion between individuals, and when do you see that they are competitors? And even that question we don't know yet. We know that, for example, they can sense different resource gradients. They can change their growth strategy depending on whether there's high or low nutrients. They change their growth strategy depending on how many different plant partners are available or how many fungal competitors that they're up against. This is all ways that they process information that allows them to evolve strategies that basically optimize those conditions for trade. So we know this because we've developed really high-resolution techniques that allow us to follow these nutrient streams across the fungal network. We see that the fungi are actually very good at taking resources from where they're very readily available and then moving them across the network to places where they're less available and the plant is willing to pay more for them. So where resources are low, they are getting more carbon in return from the plant. And so these are the kinds of experiments that we set up, is trying to understand these strategies. How do they sense where they can make these better trade deals? And you can imagine, I mean, these fungi have been under natural selection for hundreds of millions of years. It's not surprising that they would have evolved strategies that allow them to optimize their trading patterns.
Show me a video.
Okay, so I'm opening up a video right now of some of the dynamics that we're seeing inside these networks. What surprised people the most is that this is in real time, right? These are videos that are not sped up. This is actually what's happening below our feet. And so it's a very, very fast dynamic movement. And you can see that these flows are going two different directions. And not only are they going two different directions, but sometimes the fungi will change the direction of the overall flow and have it go in a completely different direction. And so really what we're trying to do, you can see now, it looks like a living river, but how can a river have so many different dynamics at once, where you can have the river banks flowing in two different directions simultaneously?
How do you map them?
Okay.
Because you've actually mapped networks in various places in the Netherlands and elsewhere. Where have you actually mapped networks of mycorrhizal fungi?
So when we talk about mapping mycorrhizal fungi, what we're talking about is mapping the biodiversity patterns. Which fungi are where and what habitats are they associated with? So this project that we have with SPUN is trying to get the first global resolution of these patterns underground. There's been a long history of mycology globally, right? People recognize that fungi, you know, they're different organisms. But a lot of the work so far has really been focused on the mushrooms, the reproductive part of the fungi. The part that stick up, the part we can eat or not eat, these are the mushrooms that have captivated the attention of the public for so long. What we're trying to have people understand is that is just the tip of the iceberg, right? That is the tiniest little ephemeral part of the fungi that comes up briefly and disappears, usually just as fast. But if we were to be able to see underground, we would see a whole different world. It's a world full of these nutrient rivers that are just pulsating with carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen, and they're connecting plant roots. And those are the networks that we're trying to map right now and understand what is the biodiversity, what is the distribution of these fungal networks, and is that changing under climate change? You know, these are ecosystem engineers. I think most people would agree now that if we lost the fungi, the soil would not stick together. It would just start washing away. Fungi are the seam that hold ecosystems together. And yet we don't know who is where. And so we've started this project as the first attempt to get a global picture of where these fungi are. In the next 18 months, we're trying to gather about 10,000 samples. And so it's a massive effort to put these fungi on the map, the way that we have maps of global vegetation or ocean currents, right? These are all systems that we have started to map. Even the stars we have better maps of than global fungi underground. And this is just key. It's just shocking to me that we haven't developed these maps, considering how important they are for our climate, how important they are for plants and therefore for animals, all surviving above ground, and yet to have no idea of how these networks connect ecosystems across the earth is shocking to me.
And you said in the beginning, they store vast amounts of carbon.
Exactly. So we're still working on refining these estimates, right? These are very, very hard estimates to get. And, you know, because we're scientists, every number that we say we want to be triple check and double check and check again. And the latest estimates, well, I guess the estimates coming out in the early 2000s were about 5 billion tons of carbon, of CO2, are flowing from plants to underground fungal networks. But this actually, so that's 5 billion tons of CO2 per year is a huge amount of carbon.
And that's just the flow. I mean, the amount that's actually cumulatively being stored must be orders of magnitude higher than that.
It's very hard to say. I mean, you have to remember that carbon is, it's a cycle. It's a very dynamic process. So a lot of carbon goes below ground, and then the fungi respire carbon. Carbon is also released. And so we're really trying to understand about what is the contribution of mycorrhizal networks to carbon sequestration underground. And that's, you know, that's a big field of study. There's a lot of really innovative scientists that are working on this question. It's a really exciting time to be studying underground fungal networks and their contribution to climate, and asking, you know, what is their role, and what happens if we continue on this trajectory of destroying fungal networks? That's what we're worried about. You know, when you till soil, when you release that carbon from these networks, it can be potentially really dangerous, and it can lead to tipping points in terms of increases in CO2, and then therefore increasing temperatures and extreme climates. And so we're really advocating for better science that's focused on this underground climate component that has been, I think, really underappreciated in both climate and conservation agendas.
In the news, we're always hearing about the great forests, the rainforest, the Amazon, all the vegetation above ground constitutes an enormous pool of carbon. But, you know, in point of fact, carbon pools beneath the soil or in the soil are larger than, if I'm not mistaken, there's more carbon stored in the soil than there is carbon in above ground vegetation.
Yeah, so 75% of terrestrial carbon is stored underground. And so how this cannot be, you know, the laser sharp focus of the climate agenda is surprising. And I think scientists have been studying this and sort of talking to each other for decades, right? I think the researchers really know what's going on, but getting that out to the public, to policymakers, that underground ecosystems are incredibly important for protecting our climate. And so how do we do that, right? I think that what we're seeing now is a real shift in consciousness, where people are starting to appreciate the biodiversity and the role that underground ecosystems play in today's climate. And that's why we need to start really working on the science and providing the data to show exactly how much, not only how much carbon, you know, I think that kind of compresses the problem, right? It really short circuits the problem. I think we're talking about whole systems, right? These are living systems that support a huge, not only store a huge amount of carbon, but support a huge amount of biodiversity below ground, right? 25% of all species live below ground. It's a huge number when we talk about overall biodiversity. And these fungal networks, they support that biodiversity. They're like the coral reefs of the soil. They're in these soil systems, which people are taking for granted, right? We're experiencing things on Earth that the fungi haven't necessarily experienced before. And that has a lot to do with chemical pollution and with fungicides and things that they've never been exposed to before. So on one hand, yes, they're robust. But on the other hand, the way that we treat our soil is inexcusable. And I think when we talk about, well, what's happening to the fungi, we have to start cataloging what we're losing, right? We have no idea what's even out there, so we don't even know what we're losing, and that's what worries me.
Have you been to places and studied places, Toby Kears, where you've seen that there are not a lot of mycorrhizal fungi? There's soils where the fungi are absent or stressed.
Of course. Yes, so we travel to ecosystems that would break your heart. So clear cuts, right? Forest clear cuts, where forests are cut and then sometimes the stumps are ripped from the ground. There's a really growing, a large and growing body of research that's showing just how negative deforestation can be for fungal networks. And sometimes it takes decades for these networks to recover. Fire systems, you know, there's some fungi that are amazing that are able to come right back after a fire system. But these symbiotic mycorrhizal networks are not one of those types of fungi, and they take a very long time to come back. And again, you know, decades can go by, and then still low levels of diversity, low levels of abundance. Agricultural systems, especially conventional agricultural systems, where, you know, there's tillage, there's pesticides, there's fungicides. You know, eventually there's just not much soil life left in these agricultural systems. And it can be brought back, right? There's a hope story here, right? This is not just about these fungi getting destroyed and never being replaced. That's what's so amazing. It takes a long time, but you can grow healthy soils back. It's just that the rate at which we are destroying soils, I think the latest UN numbers say that 90% of soils will be degraded by 2050, right? 2050, I can picture 2050. That's very soon. And so that's what we have to worry about. Not the fact that it's irreversible, but that the lands are going to be degraded so much, we're going to lose so much biodiversity, that how can we rely on them as levers in helping us get out of this whole climate scenario that we're heading for so fast. So not only we're not taking care of the fungi, but we're not using the same levels of innovation that we could be in terms of partnering with fungi to help us, you know, approach some of our biggest climate issues.
And how would we do that?
Well, that's what we're trying to advocate for, is getting more scientists on board with understanding how we can partner with fungi to help with change the climate agenda. What does it look like to have a really healthy, you know, biodiverse underground ecosystem? And how can we replicate that? How can we protect the ecosystems that are already there? If we conserve land above ground, does that necessarily, are the management strategies that we are using to, let's say, protect an amphibian that may be having falling population numbers, are those the same strategies that we would use for an endemic fungal network? We can't answer those questions yet, right? We may know how to protect a habitat for an amphibian, but we don't know how to protect a habitat yet for an endemic fungal network. And so there's just a lot of research that can be done. And also there's a lot that can be done with public awareness, right? Don't leave your soil bare, right? That's a really, really, really bad thing for fungal networks. You know, advocate for green roofs in cities. A lot of people don't know, but these fungal networks, they spread through spores airily. They're in the air, the spores, right? And so if they can have some kind of corridor of green through cities, this helps them survive. This helps them form healthy networks within the urban environment themselves, is having green spaces. So people can talk about underground forests, coral reefs, right? They can start to appreciate the organisms that live down there. And I think to be able to do that, they need to understand, they need to start being able to visualize what is under our feet. And again, that's where science can help, right? There's some really beautiful techniques that are being developed now. For example, 3D x-rays of plant fungal systems. So you actually can see what this looks like in a 3D x-ray. You can start seeing underground. And I think the public perception is going to shift as soon as they see these as living systems, the way that you see an ocean body, for example. They're just as important. It's just that they've been so invisible to the world. And we, as humans, rely so much on our sense of vision to understand systems. We need to start relying on different senses, I think, to appreciate the underground.
Toby Kears is a professor in the Faculty of Science, Ecology, and Evolution at the Free University of Amsterdam. She's also the founder of a group called SPUN, the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. Read more about SPUN and Toby Kears' research at greenplanetmonitor.net.
You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're appreciating what you're hearing, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about global ecology, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch.